We thank you for listening to WUOT. Welcome to Dialogue. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Today's Dialogue is a very special show. We're dedicating it to Dr. David Ettinger, Professor Emeritus of the UT Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department. Ett, as he is known to his friends, is a specialist on freshwater fish. He's known and recognized internationally for his ichthyology research, and he discovered the snail darter. He could not join us for the show today, but we're going to talk about him and say nice things about him, and we'll also learn why this fish is so storied. If you've never heard of the snail darter, then you probably haven't lived in Tennessee for very long, and you will definitely know by the end of this very special show. You'll know a lot more about the fish. So let's meet our guests for today. Would you each introduce yourselves and tell us what you do? Wayne, why don't you start us off?
I'm Wayne Stearns. I'm a retired research curator from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Prior to that, I worked at the Smithsonian for 14 years. And I did my dissertation on the ecology and life history of the snail darter back in the 70s.
And I'm also
a co-author of the Fishes of Tennessee with that.
Oh, okay. And you studied with Dr. Ettinger.
I did.
Zig?
Hi, I'm Zig Plotter. I teach law now in Boston, but I loved my years teaching in Tennessee. And that's how this case started. By the way, I can talk long and short. Which do you want? Because it's a long story.
We'll get to the long part for sure. We're going to tell the whole story as much as we can tell. JR?
Anyway, Ettinger.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Ettinger is a hero in my mind. And he's the kind of scientist that you can understand. And his wife, Liz, who calls herself Mrs. Snail Darter, is a wonderful companion in that couple.
Peggy and JR?
I second what Zig said about it. He's a true naturalist, and that's something that is not there are not a lot of them around anymore that teach such a wide variety about our natural world. And I learned way more than just fish by being a student of his. Peggy, my wife, and I came here in 1981 to be students of Dr. Ettinger's. And I've since, after graduating, started a nonprofit called Conservation Fisheries here in Knoxville, where we monitor and breed rare fishes for reintroduction. And part of our work has been involved in monitoring snail darters.
And I'm Peggy Shute. I've worked for about 20 years for the Tennessee Valley Authority, probably because of the lawsuit that Zig will tell us about. The group I worked with was responsible for, before TVA would do anything, put a new, turbine on a dam or put a new transmission line, they would do an environmental review. And we had to make sure that there were not going to be another snail darter issue to put us in court for a while. So that's what my group did for 20 years. And after that, I went to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for a few years while I retired just recently. And I'm happy to talk about Edson, all the great things that we learned from him. He still is a mentor for a lot of people internationally, as Chrissy said.
Yep. Charles?
Yeah, I'm Charles Sims. I'm the director of the Energy and Environment Program at the Baker Center for Public Policy. I'm an economist. I have a joint appointment in the Department of Economics, but I'm an economist that does a lot of work on environmental and natural resource economics. So I do a lot of work on the Endangered Species Act and kind of biodiversity preservation in general. I was born in 1978, so I'm the young pup here, but I grew up in Knoxville, so I was fully aware of the snail darter issue, and I actually was an undergrad here and was in one of Dr. Ettinger's undergraduate classes.
We all have a connection to him somehow. This is another very special year because of, and Zig, you can speak to this as we go along. The snail darter was one of the first species listed through the Endangered Species Act, and it's coming off of the endangered species list this year.
There were a number of, I mean, 100 or more on the U.S. list, but this was the first citizen petition to put a species on the endangered species list. And Etz and Wayne were critical to that effort.
How does it usually go? Is it not usually a petition like that, or is it? Does it come from a small group of scientists usually? And then...
There's now a Tennessee precedent, so that it's been done subsequently. But before that, it was usually the scientific community and the federal working with the international community, where there's also a listing of endangered species.
Mm. Okay. So the existence of the snail darter. Its scientific name, I'm hoping I can pronounce this correctly, Percina tenace. It's first...
Percina is correct.
Okay. It was first recorded in 1973 by Dr. Ettinger, and it's in the perch family, and it's kind of small. And that represents the sum total of what I know about this fish, other than all of the hubbub that it, you know, inadvertently caused. So why is it called... the snail darter. Let's talk about the fish itself.
Wayne, this is to you.
I think I can address that. Back in 1973, you were correct about that. Dr. Ettinger, with a specter of impoundment, you know, hanging over the Little Tennessee, the lower Little Tennessee for years, and it was starting to look more and more like it was going to happen. He realized there was very little in the way of non-game fish information in the lower Little Tennessee River. So he decided he should probably go down there and have a look. And so he and a grad student, Bob Stiles, went down and netted on one of the gravel shoals. And they came up with one or more of these darters. And like you say, darters are small members of the perch family. And this particular one's very cryptic in that it had saddle pattern on it that camouflages it very well against the gravel and sand substrates. But what happened is they put some of them in a cooler or some kind of container alive. And I guess the little fellows were getting kind of stressed out because they started pooping out little snail shells, immature snails, you know. And it became pretty evident right away that at least a pretty important component of their diet was snails, these immature snails, only a few millimeters wide. So within minutes of their discovery, they were dubbed the snail darter, which is, I suppose, a name that's lived in infamy ever since, to some degree. I heard about the snail. I was doing field work in Samoa back in 1978. I heard about the snail darter all the way around there one day on some piped-in TV news. After I got to D.C. for my years up there, I was called on twice to talk about the snail darter years after my first involvement about it. So it just comes and goes. And I think it's the way other news is going these days, I think it may outlive us all.
Yeah, seriously. It's amazing how successful it has been. I guess we should kind of set the scene a little bit, because the Tellico Dam project, it started in the mid-60s. And that was when they received congressional approval, right?
It started in 1959.
Oh, okay.
On Friday the 13th, Red Wagner said to his crew down at the Watts Bar meeting office, we got to find some way to justify building this last, do you know how many dams there are in the Tennessee River Valley?
I do not.
In the 68. This was the last one. And it was a treasure of a place as a river, as a valley, agriculture, history, but it was on the 1936 list. And so Red Wagner said, we have to build it. We have to find, you can't justify it for electricity. You can't justify it for flood. Let's find out, we'll build a city there, or Boeing will. And so the Timberlake model city became one of the two major reasons why this dam was to be built. The other was recreation. The nation was told, of course, that it was a gigantic hydroelectric dam, but I threw a pebble over it to show my students and Congress how small that dam was. And the river was known all over the United States. I was a trout fisherman, and when I came to Tennessee, I knew this river was living under a condemnation. And so when my student Hank Hill walked in and said, Etz and Wayne have discovered this endangered species, and it said to one of the farmers, this could maybe save your farms. Hank said, "Do you think that's enough for a 10-page paper?" And I said, "Yes, I think it's enough for a 10-page paper."
Probably. Okay, so the coalition against the dam, as you say, it was landowners, it was environmentalists, it was the Eastern Band of the Cherokee, some members of the Cherokee. They went back and forth, I know, until the mid-60s again, when it was finally approved by Congress. And they started construction. So when did it decide to actually go out there and start documenting the fish?
Well, as we were able to collect more, he studied the fish, you know, for the next couple of years in order to publish a formal description of it so it could be made known to the scientific world. So that was kind of the coming out party for it or any species, really. And, of course, as I said, the common name handle was already well established from the first minutes it was known. So he published that in 1976. And I came along about that time. I was in need of a dissertation project, preferably one that was funded. And so I came along right about the right time, and the Darter and I sort of found each other, and I studied them for the next 2 or 3 years to learn all I could about the ecological requirements and everything. That might be useful for, you know, future preservation efforts and so forth, and that kind of thing, and to document why Little Tennessee was, you know, extremely important to their survival and had been for years. So that's the name of that story.
Peggy and JR and Wayne, can you all talk about the Little Tennessee and how it kind of fits in with the ecology of the river valley and what's important about this special place for fish especially?
Well, the Little Tennessee has a number of dams on it, which is restricted dispersal of a lot of these rare fishes that occur through there. There are a number of fishes that occur in tributaries of the Little Tennessee, in Citico Creek and Abrams Creek and Tellico River. We've been studying fish and trying to reintroduce fish into Abrams Creek and the Tellico River for quite a few years now. We've been in business for 35 years, and we've had really good success with that. But as you get up above the Tennessee line, up into North Carolina, it's mostly a free flowing river up there, and there are a handful of endangered and or rare fishes that occupy. You got to keep in mind this is a fairly large river even when it gets up into North Carolina, and there are not a lot of those left that are unimpounded. So it's just a very important waterway for rare fishes, especially when you get up above the Tennessee North Carolina line.
But that portion of the Little Tennessee River main stem where the snail darter was found and that is now impounded by Tellico Dam, JR and I didn't come here in time to see it as a free-flowing river, and I wish we had, because it was apparently gorgeous, and as Zig and Wayne both described, you know, important for a lot of reasons besides the fish that are there and all the other probably mussels and snails and other things. But it's a huge portion of the Tennessee River drainage, and it's an important piece of it, but clearly not all of it, because the snail darter is now found in other places besides the Little Tennessee River system.
So far as we know, the Little T, the last 33 miles of flowing Little T, was the natural habitat for like 25,000 of the fish. And that's the kind of population that will survive if a river keeps flowing. And so it became the farmers who were the heart of the coalition had brought the environmental impact statement case. But the way that works is if the procedural papers say all the things that are gonna happen, they can go ahead and do them. The economics were shaky, but that wasn't something that could stop a project on the merits. So when the little fish swam into it, it was like the canary in the coal mine. you know, a sensitive little species that by its existence there is showing that humans are in danger. Humans are about to lose something important. And because of the Endangered Species Act, that fish could serve to represent the river, the farms, the Cherokee. One of the Cherokees said, that little fish is my brother, because it could make the United States look at what is being destroyed. And it was pretty clear from what the coalition and ultimately what the economists said, that this last dam was going to destroy more economic as well as ecological factors than it could ever produce. The resource economics on this project are embarrassing, but the only way that that could be raised was kind of through the canary in the coal mine, protected by the federal law. That's the American legal process. And the farmers really fought for 19 years. They were so brave, they were so good. And they brought the economics to the president's cabinet. A unanimous verdict said, this dam should not be completed. A river-based alternative feeding tourists from the interstates up into Smokies Park would be generating a huge amount of money, but we could never get the media, never mind TVA, to work on pricing the river alternative, because TVA was fixed on, even though when the hypothetical city collapsed, Boeing said no. Unfortunately, it just plowed ahead. It was a real lesson in American democracy.
Yeah, and it continued to be, because obviously, I mean, it shut down the project for a while, but then it came right back around and Congress reinstituted it.
The God Committee amendment that Senator Baker signed on to that came back and said unanimously, river-based development is worth more than all of the stuff that this lake was going to do, because the city would never happen. But the way it works in Congress is the pork barrel rolled. And so the farmers and the rest of us fought hard in the House and the Senate, went back and forth. And finally, Senator Baker twisted enough arms to pass the bill through the Senate. And Jimmy Carter threatened a veto. And we had the votes. When the president called, we said, you don't have to go along with this bill. But he didn't veto it, and the river died.
Let's take a break right there for just a minute. When we come back, we're going to rejoin the story, and we're going to hear a little bit more about how the economics of rivers work from Charles Sims. He's going to help us with that. Thank you for listening to Dialogue. This is WUOT. You're listening to Dialogue on WUOT. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. We're discussing the snail darter, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and now we've gotten into a conversation about the economics of rivers and dams. And Charles, can you weigh in on this a little bit as far as your study of economics and how environmental policy sort of impacts that?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think it's surprising that there are a lot of these dams didn't make sense economically. I mean, this is one, but I mean, there's been plenty of examples of other dams that didn't make sense economically either. And you know, I don't know much about. I know who was on the God Committee who was determining these things, and I'm fully confident that it was a good analysis. But I don't know much about it myself. I think what it did do was it brought up some questions about how to actually implement the Endangered Species Act that were never really discussed when it was passed. And so whether this, you know, whether the economics made sense on this one policy or not, it did point out, like a lot of environmental policy, that when Congress passes these things, they don't exactly tell you how to put it into place and actually do it, right? There's a lot of vagary to it. And so there were a lot of a lot of thorny issues around trade-offs between economic development and species preservation that never really got discussed in the legislation itself. And this was kind of the first chance that we really had to kind of air those out on a national scale and talk about what these things meant. And And we're still dealing with a lot of these today. We haven't really resolved these issues. I mean, when we talk about, what is driving listing decisions and delisting decisions today, it's supposed to be driven entirely by scientific information, but there's lots of evidence that shows that it's driven by other things, right? So these economic things are probably bleeding into the decisions of what to list and not list and what how much spending to have on certain species versus others. But there was never really a formal mechanism for which those kind of discussions could go about. And so sort of now they're kind of haphazard. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to the effort to put together a GOD committee. I mean, it was sort of recognizing that at some point there needs to be a discussion about these trade-offs. I don't know if it was the best way to do it, but I'm sympathetic to the recognition that the policy at the time was simply we must preserve every species at no matter the cost, right?
Right.
And clearly that was just not tenable in the long term for every single species. There needed to be some way of thinking about weighing particular benefits and costs, and particularly thinking about the distributional issues of it. Most of these endangered species issues, we're thinking of benefits that are accruing to to the whole world, right? Or if you're thinking of U.S., or you're at least thinking of there are benefits that are accruing to U.S. citizens overall, but the costs are really honed in on one group of people, right? And so it's a question about a small group of people paying the costs to preserve a species that's going to benefit society as a whole. So really, I think we're still just kind of grappling with how to deal with these issues because the policy, the legislation itself didn't really lay out these ways of thinking about it. And if no other reason than it brought this up and got this conversation going.
And the perspective is obviously going to be different for every single species that you have the conversation about, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a case by case thing that's hard to weigh in. But like I said, I know from colleagues that have been doing work on kind of what affects listing decisions and what affects spending decisions, there's lots of things that feed into it. I mean, for instance, vertebrates are way more likely to be listed than plants or invertebrates. That's not because they just happen to be more threatened, right? It's just because people like vertebrates more. So there are things like that that are feeding into these decisions. It's not being entirely driven by threat or which species are more important genetically and things like this, which was sort of at the heart of what the initial legislation said it was supposed to be doing.
Dr. Sims is right. This is an incredibly complicated issue, and it's not just economics. But the stunning thing about the snail darter case is that it is a prime example of how good ecology makes good economics and bad ecology makes bad economics. Now, that isn't always universal, but in this case, it was extraordinarily true that because that fish was a barometer of the last high quality flowing river in the region, and it had this potential, it was drawing people from all over the East to come to that river, even though it was undeveloped. The economics of a river-based development were really extraordinary. And it was only the ecology that identified that. And ultimately, we lost the ecology, and that's not just an economic issue, but it's important to recognize that protecting species is often not an economic problem, because the major cause of endangerment is what? Poisoning, shooting. No, it's habitat destruction.
Yeah.
And that often means that habitat that humans need and use is being destroyed as well. So the first law of ecology is what? Everything is connected to everything else. And as Dr. Sim says, that makes it complicated.
Well, let's go back to the fish. How was it obvious that the snail darter and other members of this large group of fish were being harmed by the construction of the dam?
Wayne, you can answer that. This looked like a relict population, right?
Yes, I think the Little Tennessee served fortuitously as a refugium for this species over some years, even though it was a pretty lean population in there, because we are virtually sure they did not occur any longer in the lower Holston and French Broad rivers. they had been sampled extremely intensely by TVA and everybody that were looking for other populations. And so I think that the healthy populations that are there now stem from the reintroductions from the little tea population. So it was very important. Tide me over kind of population until we could get things done. Now, that darter probably occurred throughout the main channel of the Tennessee River prior to all the impoundments, because it is very tolerant of larger streams and the like, and then it was very fragmented, by all the impoundments of the main channel of the Tennessee River. There was no sampling for small fishes ever done in the main channel of the Tennessee River, if you can believe that, prior to the 1940s when they started damming it up. So we don't know what was there, but we can speculate because this thing occurred throughout the lower reaches of tributaries, and those tributaries are very important to its continued reproduction and everything. So a lot of the populations we have now came from the mother population at the Little Tennessee. The TVA did a lot of restocking and the like, so it was incredibly important for that. And
The restocking program just for the snail darter, or were there other fish involved in that too?
Just the snail darter in this case. And, they were hoping to get, it was a way to try to circumvent the act and say, well, we've got all these other populations established now. We can go ahead and do in the Little Tennessee. And that's particularly what happened, basically what did happen.
We can talk about the restocking and the transplantation, but it's pretty clear the best place to conserve a species is in its pre-existing natural population.
Oh, sure.
And one of the problems with the delisting, which I petitioned for, was that it requires TVA to keep putting liquid oxygen, and also to pulse the dams to clean the gravel, and that has to go on forever. And that obviously is not the ideal way you want to conserve a species, so that humans have to keep working for it. I just don't buy eternity as a good answer.
I have so many questions about that. Go ahead, Wayne.
I think that the main thing is that there was a reintroduction to former habitats in the Holston and French Broad, but those rivers have had a history of bad water quality for a long time, and it was probably extirpated from there. And then those rivers have improved in the decades since, and so putting it back in there was a successful reestablishment. They were heavily sampled before the reintroductions, and they just weren't turning up any snail darters in there at that time, so I think basically we're putting them back into good physical habitat that managed to persist, but the water quality had been pretty bad for decades prior to the reestablishment.
Yeah.
Wayne is right that the Clean Water Act is part of the story, and the Endangered Species Act, TVA really worked hard to figure out how to make those reintroduction populations survive by cleaning up the dam just below to the dams through pulsing. I mean, it is a success story of human effort to make those reintroductions possible.
I absolutely agree. When I was working at TVA before Fish and Wildlife Service, I was part of a consultation on all those dams, all the 62 dams that TVA operated in the system. And we looked at every dam and what endangered species, plant and animal, aquatic and terrestrial, that could be affected by things like raising and lowering the water levels in the reservoir during the year, and how they released the water. And I think the Endangered Species Act, which required this consultation on any alterations of how they operated the whole system, that's one of the reasons that the Endangered Species Act works, because it forced TVA to look at what they were doing and how the effects were playing out all through the ecology, as you mentioned, Zig. And I think because of that, that's why I felt really good about the Endangered Species Act requirements, consultations. It's a hassle for the agencies that have to do it, but it really didn't cost them anything in the long run. It benefits all of us, and they get all they should deserve the credit for doing the right thing. It cost them a lot of money in some places, but it benefits more than just financially. It benefits the world. And as a result, I think that's partly why the snail darter has been able to survive and improve its population status throughout the whole Tennessee River system now, which results in this proposal. And I didn't know, Zig, that you were one of the ones that petitioned to delist it. Thank you for that, because I think it should have been petitioned a while back. I think it's absolutely
years.
Deserved. So, you know, I think the ESA works.
How do you decide? No, go ahead, Charles.
I was just going to say, to follow up on that, I mean, I think a lot of the listeners might be thinking, well, surely a fish species that was listed in the 70s would be delisted by now, right? But it's not a foregone conclusion, right? I mean, I was calculating this before the call here. So since the passage of the ESA in 1973, there's been almost 2,400 species that have been listed as endangered or threatened, and only 58 of them have been delisted because they've recovered. So
wow.
It's a huge deal that it actually made it back all the way off the list. Not all of these species make them off the list. So to kind of follow up on that point, the ESA does work. And I think this is an important point, because a lot of critics of the ESA have cited the fact that, well, there's so few species that actually get delisted. Clearly the ESA isn't working, right? If it was working, we would see all of these species getting delisted pretty quickly. But so to have something like the snail darter that everyone has heard of, that had such national attention drawn to it, to eventually be delisted is certainly a feather in the ESA's cap to say, no, this is working. It may take a while, but eventually these species make it off the list.
The change happens slowly.
It took 40 years and good faith. TVA turned around and started trying to do the right thing under the Act. And the Clean Water Act, as Wayne was saying, really helped the entire region and the little fish along with it.
And Etz would be one of the first persons, and I've heard him say it many times, to applaud TVA for what they did to change operations to make things better for the fish and people.
I just wish that TVA had shown the public what the river-based development would have been. It would have been an incredibly lucrative development, bringing those tourists up through the valley and into the park. The superintendent of the park said, that is the way to make this park get more and better usage by people from all over the country. The God Committee analysis totally ignored the tourism possibilities. The Cherokee Trail that we were talking about, coming up from the interstate along the river, then across to the Foothills Parkway and into the park at Townsend. I mean, it really would have been extraordinary. And TVA at that time was adamant. Red Wagner said, I'm not going to lose a project to citizen complaints. And I'm so glad that TVA has mostly changed its ways. The good faith on this effort, as Wayne and Charlie and Peggy are saying, really made a difference.
Charles?
Zig, you can speak to this, but I believe indirectly the Teleco and everything that people went through with that may have indirectly saved the Duck River because of the two dams that were removed there. One of them was pretty much completed and it was blown up. And the Duck River is one of the most diverse rivers in the entire of North America, one of the top two or three.
And I have a piece of the Duck River Columbia Dam that Charlie sent me after they blew it up. It's clear that the precedent established by the snail darter case has lived longer than the Little Tea River, so that other pork projects really don't get completed because they say, well, if as an extreme a case as that is protected by the court system, maybe we better not keep going with projects that are shaky.
Well,
and the Columbia was shaky.
I have a piece of that concrete too laying on my windowsill here in my office at home.
Well, that's my question.
We should put it in the auction for WUOT this year.
No, you keep it. That's my question, though, is Is the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act, are they as powerful now in keeping some of these projects from happening as they were then?
Well, see, when I worked at TVA for those 20 years with that job that resulted from this lawsuit, I promise you, we did projects every day because we finally had convinced the people that were putting these projects on the board to be funded and implemented. We did projects every day that got changed because something was in the way that might cause trouble. And we were able to convince those project managers that if you let us in early enough before your planning is so far down the road that you can't change it, that we were able to let them do that before it was too much trouble. And we changed things all, every drop in the bucket added up. And I firmly believe that it still happens over there. It happens in most agencies that I know of from the other side, from Fish and Wildlife Service working with those agencies. It happens. People don't hear about it because they don't make it to the project status that Tellico Dam or Columbia Dam was. I saw Columbia Dam sitting in the middle of a field down there near in South Central Tennessee, and the water was flowing around it because the endangered species consultation had stopped it. That stuff doesn't happen anymore because intervention happens early enough if the agencies are doing their jobs correctly, and it doesn't cost them trouble because they let that happen in the planning stages. So I firmly believe from both sides of the coin that the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act and the National Historic Preservation Act and all of those regulations that force agencies to think about it carefully before they actually plan it so strongly and implement it, they work. They do work. People don't hear about it, and that's a good thing, in my opinion.
Right. It's not just dams. It's this precedent is taught in all the law schools now, and it means that programs and projects in the chemical industry, in transportation, in a lot of other areas where maybe there was narrow-minded planning, gets broader planning now because of a precedent that people know, oh, there's something that could be a violation of the law that we can avoid by doing it right, the way Peggy was talking.
Right, and nobody wants to end up in court, wasting the time, wasting the money. Is that borne out in your experience, Charles, in your research as well, that, you know, all of these environmental concerns, what the requirements are, those are packed into the project's costs from the beginning, and economic questions as far as the development of some of these projects nationwide?
I think they are. I mean, I think once they know that these species are there, they recognize there's going to be additional costs involved. Getting back to Zig's point, I think it really depends on how you define success here, right? Because yeah. I think in a lot of these programs, they may be, you know, a company might be able to develop a habitat as long as they, you know, invest in preserving habitat elsewhere, right? These are kind of these offsets that you hear talked about quite a bit. So, you know, in this case, they might have been able to develop one stretch of river if they could ensure that they were protecting somewhere else, right? So there's now mechanisms in place to do those types of things. So if you're concerned about the preservation of the species, then maybe that's okay. Maybe that works for you. If you're more concerned about the preservation of the habitat, then maybe those offsets bother you a little bit more because you're worried about that one particular habitat rather than the species as a whole. So I think folks are factoring these things in. They have more flexibility probably today to kind of deal with these cost issues than they may have had early on. And like I said before, this has all come about because of this discussion about, you know, can we make the endangered, can we still preserve species without putting so many costs on firms and landowners that may be impacted by the species designation?
Yeah.
The delisting is also a way of telling people how to do it right. And this delisting petition, I mean, people were surprised that the two of us who sent the petition and Jim Williams and I had fought so hard to list the species. But, well, actually, look at the date. We filed the petition in June of 2019. The prior administration had already gutted several regulations of the Endangered Species Act. And we had heard that there was a thought to delist the darter without protective requirements. And so we were looking at a year and a half of further troubles, or 5.5 years. And it seemed that by writing the petition and being part of the process, we could build in the kinds of things that Charlie and Peggy were talking about as requirements. It was a preemptive political decision that, as you can imagine, we were ambivalent about, because transplantation is not the easy answer. It's a 40-year answer in this case. The best place to keep a species is in its natural habitat, if you can. And as Dr. Sims would figure out, and the habitat in this case had tremendous economic possibilities.
And I think there's been, I mean, over the years, people have realized that having a species on the endangered species list does impose lots of cost. I think at the time, companies, whoever it is, would just ignore the listing and didn't see it coming and didn't realize maybe what the economic implications would be. Well, we now have years of realizing how costly it is. And so we have better evidence that firms are proactively trying to keep stuff off of the list because they realize that it's going to eat into their bottom line.
Another way
which the ESA has been helpful is to kind of potentially keep these things off the list beforehand, with firms recognizing that, man, once they get on the list, this is really going to up the cost of this project or kind of limit what we can do with the project after it's built.
But Peggy's point is that it's that very often the project developers say, we better do this project right in the first place,
right,
because there could be a species problem down the road. So, you know, having it on the list is often an incentive for rational planning, taking account of all the real costs and all the alternatives, not just the normal, let's build it and then think about whether we can justify it.
Okay, a couple of questions as we wind down the show. Peggy and JR, especially, and Wayne, you guys are, you know, you've worked in the field for a long time. And my question, I think, is when the Endangered Species Act was first implemented, it seemed like, from what I've read and my own experience in watching some of these cases go through the courts and the list, these were the only ways to get people to rethink some of these projects and developments. I'm wondering if the attention has shifted from being species-centric to now overall habitat. Do you see that, or do you still feel like concentrating on these individual species is the way that it's still going? These are still the way to get companies to pay attention.
I think that concentrating on habitat is definitely the way to go, and you can accomplish more through that than you can trying to protect individual species in that. And keeping good habitat does a lot for the economy as well. I mean, you know, if you look at the names of all the little campgrounds and everything else.
JR, we're having a hard time hearing you.
Campground or clear Crystal Waters campground or something. Nobody wants to camp beside a nasty, muddy, you know, screwed up stream. So there's an economic incentive to keep these habitats in good condition. And a lot of times by keeping the habitat in good condition, you therefore protect the animals that are in there, not just a species, but all of the species.
And humans too. You're talking about ecosystems.
Exactly.
And ecosystem services. Sometimes, for instance, you keep a marsh and it catches floodwaters that otherwise would be charging down on a city. There are really billions of dollars of services that nature provides for free that don't get valued unless there's some kind of legal signification.
Right.
And ecosystems are really the bottom line.
And also related to that is that mean, this is our drinking water source.
JR, I
some
think
of these rivers and streams, and it costs a lot more to treat nasty water. Pardon?
Oh, no. We're just, you're in and out. Your sound is in and out, so I'm not sure what's happening there.
I think endangered species will always serve as the canaries in the coal mine to get people's attention on these kinds of places. And so they will always have significance and, you know, maybe even serve as a bellwether in some cases for these kinds of things. So I don't think we can ever diminish their importance.
What can we say about this? You know, last week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that more than 20 species are being delisted because they're extinct. And I'm not, you know, I certainly wouldn't say that that's the fault of the Endangered Species Act. It has done what it has done. But we clearly have not been successful in every attempt to save species, right?
I think that a lot of those species are mussels. And mussels live for a long time. Some of them maybe, 100 years. But they probably have been extinct for 40 or 50 years, and the data needed to document that they really are extinct has not been available, and Fish and Wildlife Service has been afraid to just come out and say it until now, I think. So I don't think that things are getting worse. I think these were species that probably were already extinct, and they just needed to make up their minds to go ahead and say so.
The ivory-billed woodpecker is a good example of that. You know, it's probably been gone a long time, and they're just now getting around to delisting it and declaring it extinct. Hopefully it's not, but it's not looking good.
Right.
I was just thinking of that, the ivory-billed. I would love to see that, but it turns out that it's human causes that woodpecker lost its habitat and ultimately lost its existence. And it's like climate. When there is a human cause, there's something that we can work on to change things. And there's still thousands of species there. As many of them are subject, it seemed to me, to extinction more than ever before because of humans. E.O. Wilson says it's 100 times more than the natural extinction rate because of humans. Right. So human behavior is going to be part of the answer.
Well, let's say a few words about the snail darter, because, again, it's a success story. It's not only a success story because of the mitigation efforts and TVA helping to restore the species, but it's been an ongoing, it's been in the spotlight for a long time. It is the subject of extensive research. And as you say, Peggy, it has expanded its territory down into, Alabama? And
Mississippi, yeah.
Yeah. So some final words for Dr. Ettinger and the snail darter.
What a legacy. Hooray.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's going to be, continue to be the hallmark for successful endangered species stories for a long time. And a lot of that was because of, the context that happened in and all the resources it commanded to help with the effort. That's a lot more than a lot of these other listed species probably get. And a lot of those things that are probably being delisted as extinct now are things that were very isolated, single populations, very vulnerable to extirpation. And so the snail darter was a little bit more and resilient because of the fact that they can live in different places once the water quality comes back up. So it's different for every species.
The recovery is a mitigated success, not an unmitigated success, because what the snail darter could have shown the United States and as well as Tennessee was the incredible value of what its natural habitat would provide for us. It's a saga of farmers working in the political process in Washington. It really is an amazing story that I think people would find enlightening and encouraging, even though ultimately the politics eliminated the river. That little darter is like a hero, like David Ettmeyer.
Yes. And if anybody out there wants to hear more about the snail darter, there's plenty of information. Zig wrote a book. Wayne wrote a book. Peggy and JR may have written a book. I don't know. Not yet.
Not yet.
I want to thank all of our guests for being here today. Wayne Starnes, Zig Plotter, Peggy and JR Shute, and Charles Sims. Thank you all so, so much. If you have a question about any of these folks, I've got links already on the website at wuot.org. Thank you to Greg Hill for production. Thank you to all of you for listening. This episode will be up on the website in just a bit at wuot.org. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News, and we thank you for supporting public radio at WUOT.